I can so picture now, like a younger Natalie in her little seat or whatever, gripping her pencil so tightly in her fist, right? And just her cheeks glowing, just like so excited, but also nervous, like,
Yep, everything you're picturing is 100% accurate.
yeah. This is All Things Education, a podcast where three-decade teachers discuss what they know.
The good, the not so good, and the continuous opportunity for high quality education in Texas.
Join us for a smart conversation as we dig deep into the issues that affect us all in and around our great state.
And here are those three collected instructors now. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to All Things Education. My name is Lance, and I am a high school teacher of mathematics up here in the great Metroplex, that is Dallas-Fort Worth.
Hey, y'all. I'm Matthew, a middle school electives teacher in Austin, Texas.
And I'm Natalie, a campus leader turned back to an art ed English teacher, potentially. I don't know what I am currently, but I am in transition and we'll figure it out before August. I'll keep you guys posted. Stay tuned.
There is no more June anecdote or share out than what you just said in the world of a teacher. Besides trying to beat the heat, sometimes there's job transition, subject transition, learning new professional development ideas, going to trainings, etc. So my question to y'all as we kick off another great episode of All Things Education is, how are y'all beating the heat, either professionally or in your personal lives?
Well, for me, I did not beat the heat. The heat bit me yesterday on my first official day of summer. I was outside doing a bunch of yard work that was long overdue and could not be postponed any longer. But today I'm beating it by having my son go out and finish that task. And I'm sitting in here chatting with you guys.
Delegation.
You, Matt?
That's awesome. I can't beat that one. I just took my dog for a walk at 7 in the morning. And so, yeah, I guess just trying to wake up early and get outside early. And other than that, spending time at the pool. And
there you
swimming.
Go. Speaking of yard work, do y'all have trouble here in Texas trying to thread that needle of it's not too hot, but I also don't want to wake the neighbors with my lawnmower, you know? What's
Oh
the
yeah.
ideal
Yep.
time for that? I don't know
Yes.
the answer.
I feel like 8:30 or 9 is respectable, but in some places that's too late even.
If you push it to
Sunday
10,
morning
then
at
you're
7 a.m.
yeah, exactly. Anyways, I love those stories. Thanks for sharing as always. And let's get to business. We won't talk too long about the Texas legislature this time, as we've been doing all year so far, but it is worth noting that the gavel has been stowed away for another 2 years, and the lawmakers are on the homebound front to their families because the 89th session is officially over and potentially will be old news by the time our audience is listening to this. So just kind of looking back, you know, memories, as they say, Matthew, Natalie, what will you remember years from now or months from now, maybe, about the 2025 session, specifically in the landscape of Texas Ed? Matthew, what are you going to remember about this year?
Yeah, ESAs, for sure, or vouchers. This was obviously a big topic, as it was in the previous session. And it passed. So we are looking at a experimental form of privatizing public education in the state of Texas. I think that this is going to have, it certainly has the potential to have huge impact on education in our state, on school choice for parents, and on the public school systems. So I am definitely curious to see how this all plays out in the next year or two. And I am curious to see how our elected officials respond to its impacts. But yeah, this is definitely an interesting topic, and we will see how it all plays out. My hope is that the ESAs do what our legislators said they were intended to do, and that is to provide more opportunity for those in need.
Right.
But we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see how it plays out.
And it definitely will impact Texas parents and families directly. So
Yep.
it's definitely going to be memorable from this particular session. Natalie, what about you? What are you going to remember?
I think one of the biggest items that had us on the edge of our seats up to the bitter end was the school funding bill, which did ultimately pass at $8.5 billion, and that money is allocated in specific strategic ways, according to the state legislature, what they believe to be the priorities this session. And the one that benefits us the best is that portion of $4 billion, about half of that bill, just shy of half of the bill, is really reserved for teacher and staff pay raises, and expansion of the teacher incentive allotment. Now, there's so many numbers thrown around in the conversations and the back and forth up till the very end when they finally got it through. I'll be curious to see what that translates to the cent on our paychecks, right? And it'll be different for all of us depending on what content we're in, what means our district have overall, and also whether or not you qualify for that teacher incentive allotment to begin with, or if your district even offers it. But they are expanding that. They've made teacher pay a priority, which is great. Where it still falls a little bit short is actually with regard to campus funding in the form of the basic allotment. We didn't see a lot of increase there. I know district leaders are stressed about that still, and there will be an impact to staffing and to the programs on campuses because we're still under-resourced as a district in most cases, but we get a little bit of a win, and there's still progress to be made. So that's sort of the name of the long game there.
Totally. And just for our listeners, that teacher incentive allotment that Natalie's talking about, that's this kind of basic idea that if I'm a better teacher, I might make more, a merit-based system, which has seen a lot of variance in rollout across the state. My district in Dallas, for example, has a very robust program, not without its flaws, but around Texas, based on where you go, maybe it's not there or maybe it looks a little different. So, yeah. Very interesting funding related updates there. So yeah, we've got vouchers, we've got funding. And sometimes in the legislature, you can even make headlines when you don't pass something, right? We see all these headlines about bill doesn't make it out of House or bill doesn't make it out of Senate. And this year at the wire, barely a week ago here in early June, we had a failed bill that made headlines about the STAR test. Most of our listeners probably know about the STAR test. Just in case you don't, it's the kind of backbone of public ed that we do a standardized test of our students at the end of the school year. This is from grade school or from, kindergarten. I don't know if they do it in kindergarten, but from elementary school all the way up to exit level of high school. STAR here in Texas stands for the State of Texas Assessment of Academic Readiness. And there was a bill that made it out of House and then stalled in the Senate that was potentially going to scrap this system in favor of potentially some shorter tests throughout the year, or a lot of other different ideas were kind of in the soup there. But it's not happening, right? And so we've got the headline, but we don't actually have the quote unquote progress. What exactly happened there, Matthew, when it came to the House side of things?
So the House was really hoping to reduce the over-reliance on high-stakes testing. And this was pretty much across the board. The argument here is that the STAR testing kind of dominates classroom time, it narrows the curriculum, it places too much emphasis, too much pressure on testing. And the House also wanted to address student well-being. A big argument here, and there's a lot of research behind that, is that high-stakes tests like the STAR actually negatively impact students' mental health. that this is just like putting too much pressure, too much stress on students and teachers alike. The House wanted to support alternative assessment models. They weren't saying, okay, the House wasn't necessarily saying we're going to get rid of testing or we're going to get rid of these measures of accountability, but they were looking into other assessment models, similar to what we have now as the MAP testing, which measures growth. And then finally, the House wanted to give a little bit more control to districts, to have local districts have a little bit more input in terms of, you know, this kind of testing and how they were going to measure accountability and student progress and all that, rather than have it be top down. So from the teacher's perspective or from my perspective, these are all good reasons to do away with the STAR or to make some significant changes to high stakes testing in Texas.
And it potentially could have created some positive outcomes for students and families when it comes to stress.
Yeah, absolutely.
And learning, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, there's also the equity issue, right? That English language learners and students with disabilities, those who are coming from economically disadvantaged communities, that they all have a disadvantage here when presented with these kinds of assessments, and that the STAR only exasperates that. It doesn't actually fix anything.
Right.
I might talk about that a little bit later, but
sounds good. And this was a kind of championed by the head of the Education Committee, Brad Buckley, in the form of House Bill 4. Then we look over at the Senate side of things and we saw a little bit less enthusiasm, right, Natalie? What was kind of the issue on that side?
Well, it's pretty clear to those of us that are following it closely that the Senate had a different priority in this particular legislation. I don't know that anybody in the Senate would disagree with the instructional implications of STAR testing. And I think they're very receptive, most lawmakers, to hearing from teachers and school leaders to understand how that trickle down impacts ultimately the student outcomes. However, they didn't get so far as to have those conversations, or maybe they were less receptive than the House, because it seemed like most school leaders were going to the House to dispute this and to discuss it. But the Senate's priority was more about protecting the power up at the top, in my opinion. Those are my words, and I take full responsibility for those. They wanted to solidify the TEA's authority to set stricter standards for the rating system. And this comes, you know, after, for a while, when they first intertwined testing and accountability, you know, schools were filing suit because they disagreed with the grades that they were assigned. And that, of course, impacts enrollment and who they're able to serve. So school leaders have been filing suit in recent years, holding up some of the release of those scores. And they kind of finally came out anyway, which created a big upheaval in the midst of all of the voucher discussion. It's all very spaghetti, right? It's all intertwined. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, they could not agree on how much power schools, districts, district leaders had in fighting against those scoring systems and the release of those scores. So that's kind of where it got held up. By the time the House had an opportunity, I think, to rewrite some of the legislature to try to appease or come to a compromise with the Senate on that component, they just simply ran out of time. They couldn't get it through.
That's a perfect summary. Thanks to both of you. So it won't actually be changing this time around, maybe next time. So on the one hand, that's a big failure, right? We spent all this time and accomplished, quote unquote, nothing, but maybe it wasn't. Perhaps instead of addition by not necessarily subtraction, this could be addition by inaction if you look at it from one side or the other. But let's get away from the legislative session for a minute and just talk about standardized testing in general, which is a prevalent force in our lives, not just us teachers, but for parents of any kid that's in the public school system here in Texas or throughout the country. Standardized testing is a behemoth, right? And it's an old behemoth. It dates all the way back to the 18th century in the United States and has had so many different forms and functions in different parts of the country, even here in Texas. So, at the very least, it's a fixture of how we do things in public ed since long before you and me and any of my colleagues have come along. We'll even post a link in the show notes about the history of public testing here in Texas, which started around 1979 and has been changed quite frequently since then. 1990, 1993, 1996, 1999. We're always trying to do it a little bit better, right? We're innovating as we go along. Just as a really personal example, I took something called the TACS test when I was a high school senior in 2005, the Texas Assessment of Knowledge and Skills. 1 year prior to that, my sister, who was 1 year before me, took a test called TAS, TAAS. Were these wildly different tests? Who knows? Did they have a different acronym signifying what you were doing? Of course they did. And as mentioned, our current students are taking STAR. But honestly, it's not a good idea to even try to keep up with these acronyms for our listeners, because standardized testing might change again, as we just talked about, in the next legislative session or beyond. So, really quickly, y'all, what's just any particular anecdote or story that y'all have with your interaction with standardized testing over the years?
So the first thing I think of when I think of standardized testing as a kid was that glorious moment where you took your pencil and you ripped open the binding on the edge of the book. And that's right, folks, it was on paper, this test.
Whoa.
It was on paper, not on a Chromebook, but there was something so gratifying. You didn't know how the test was going to be or how it was going to go. You did your best, but man, did you live for that rip of the edge of the binding on the book. And I remember that one test, it was like math and reading, right? Like always. One test was on one side of the book and the other test was on the other side of the book. You had to flip it over. And if you opened the wrong side of the book on the wrong day, boy, you were afraid you were going to go to prison for life.
This was serious
That,
business.
yes. And that was the TOS test. I am a TOS survivor.
Okay, gun to your head. What does the acronym stand for? TOS.
Texas Assessment of Academic Skills. We talked about this on a previous episode. I don't know if y'all remember. We were
Incredible.
totally like phoning a friend on what the acronyms meant, but they all essentially mean the same thing. We need to demonstrate what we know as students. And so that's what I remember about the TOS test. I couldn't tell you anything about the quality of the exam because as a kid, I was not concentrated on that. I only cared about that rip.
I did not take the TACS or the STAR or the TOS or any of that. I didn't grow up in Texas. I did not take high stakes standardized testing in all of elementary and secondary in Massachusetts. But that doesn't mean I don't have an anecdote. So I remember this was, oh man, this was probably like 6 years ago. We were giving a STAR test. This one was in math, 8th grade, and I was turning in my materials. At the end of the test, teachers have this big bin. They walk down to the book room or to the office or whatever, and they turn in their materials. And you turn in your test, you turn in your booklet, you turn in your scrap paper, and so forth. And there's little bins and a whole system. And I'm sure every school does it differently, but it's very, very systematic. And I was turning in my scratch paper for the math assessment. And I put it in the bin. And then I was signing something or filling out some form or whatever. And it was brought to my attention that in that scratch paper that I put in the bin, there was a sheet of paper with what appeared to be formulas, math formulas printed. And they asked me what this was. And I said, I don't know.
Your stomach dropped.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. My heart dropped. And so this became a huge situation. I mean, there's so much pressure, and there's so much that goes into these tests. It's ridiculous or whatever. But my heart dropped or whatever, and we had to conduct a full investigation. I'd never seen this paper. I had no idea whose it was, but it looked like it was like maybe like four equations or whatever, or formulas. And it wasn't any of the scaffolded material that we hand out during this test. And so this was a mystery paper. And so, the administration got heavily involved in this. They conducted really serious one-on-one interviews or basically interrogations with some of the students, and so forth. And it just like was like a week of huge amounts of anxiety and, what's going to happen with my job or whatever. And it turned out in the end that it was not my paper that I had turned in. It was the previous teacher who had been turning in the scratch paper or whatever. She was a sped teacher, and this was a legitimate scaffold for
Oh, that's
one of
good.
the students. So there was no foul on my part, no serious consequence. But it was a stressful week for sure.
Yeah, well, that's part and parcel with this whole concept of high stakes testing, right? That's exactly what it is. As a teacher, those are some of the times of the year when I most feel like if I make a mistake, my job is on the line with the irregular scoring reports or whatever we have to do.
For our listeners, a couple of clarifying points. SPED, meaning special education, for the student that Matthew was talking about, and also teachers are threatened. I mean, it's part of the training. It comes with the responsibility of the security of these assessments and the materials, comes with the threat of either sanctions against us or the loss entirely of our certificate and our ability to practice as instructional experts. So, just to sort of explain the gravity of that situation and the reason it was so scary for Matthew. And I think you just described every teacher's fear, especially new
There's a lot
teachers.
of
They're
fear.
so scared the first time. I'm like, breathe. It's okay. It's gonna be fine. Anyway, I wanted to interject that.
No, that was great. Great clarification. It's no laughing matter, right? For kids, parents, teachers, administrators, anyone involved. And you know what? Somehow we all tacitly agree that these results matter. They don't just matter, they mean everything, right? The results of these tests is like paramount. And it's a non-politicized thing. Both sides of the aisle are kind of on board with this. 20 years ago, we had No Child Left Behind, which really kind of reformed the standardized testing system nationwide. 10 or 15 years ago, we had Common Core, which was about standards that we all can follow. We're all trying to fix or perfect this system. But my argument maybe suggests the opposite. Should we even care about these results? Let's talk about the system itself. For example, the scores are coming back, but where are those scores coming from? Or who potentially is behind those scores? For example, I'm not alone in being troubled by a recent report from earlier in 2024. This was reported out by Talia Richman at the Dallas Morning News that many scores were completed erroneously in the 2024 STAR test administration. In fact, originally, the scores had been done with an automated system. Last month, we talked about AI in the classroom. And then, after a score report change was a score report request change form was submitted by Dallas ISD, they were rescored by humans. And this actually led to an improvement in scores of over 40% of the students in the sample. Even from TEA themselves, the Texas Education Agency, an official said that, and he was trying to downplay the magnitude of this misscoring issue, he remarked that 3% of the DISD written essay submissions earned higher marks upon rescoring. And he said only 3%, right? That's a low number, only 3%. That's within the margin of error. But, basic statistics, DISD, 3% of kids would be about 5,000 kids. So as a parent myself, or to the parents in our audience, it does not necessarily seem far-fetched that this problem could affect your kid, right? You had a lower score than you needed. We can also expand this out to the district level or the kind of idea of what we are looking at with our schools when we look at the ratings mostly being based on these scorings. Matthew and Natalie, what does it mean as a teacher when the results are not necessarily accurate at the assessment level, or if we cannot believe that the results are reliable? What does that mean for us as teachers?
Yeah, I mean that I think that negates the purpose of the test, right? If we're not getting accurate data, then that defeats the whole reason why we're, assessing the kids. So that's really troubling. I do know of other instances in the past where the results did not line up accurately. And I mean, look, Texas is a huge state, tons of districts, very diverse. You're gonna have these technical problems, occur and pop up. I think a really interesting point you made is like, should we care about the results to begin with? So I mean, we've been doing standardized testing in Texas and in the nation since the early 1980s. And then it ramped up, of course, in 2001 with No Child Left Behind. But there's no evidence that long-term gains in learning are being made. Actually, in fact, it's pretty stagnant, if not in decline. In Texas, it's been pretty stagnant for a while. In terms of gains. So that's a concern. And then you, of course, you also have the negative psychological and school climate effects of having so much emphasis on testing. My biggest concern with the testing is that it narrows the curriculum, and it makes it so that, teaching and, what we're learning in school is way less innovative. So those are my big concerns when it comes to the test. But yeah, if the data is not accurate, then what are we doing, right? It, not to mention this is costing a fortune.
Man, I have so many things going through my brain right now. All the buzzwords you were just talking
I gave
about.
a lot.
Matthew, you said something that really kind of touched on what we were talking about last week with the AI thing, and I won't go down that rabbit hole, but as it pertains to the conversation about testing, we haven't seen a lot of innovation and progress there, but in this tech aspect, we're seeing innovation, which equals automation, and we're talking about how that is detrimental to the quality of a student's learning experience. So I just wanted to kind of leave that there so that y'all can deal with it in your craw because it's a lot for me to deal with in my own. Everybody join the party there. But to get back to Lance, your original question of what does this mean as a teacher when the results of an assessment are unreliable? I mean, it means everything because it feels like the goalpost is constantly moving. So from a professional standpoint, and even for the students, it's like, okay, where is the measure? Where is the mark? Where do we show that we've done it? From a very basic and fundamental standpoint, the assessment that we're offering to measure a student's success should align with the instruction that they're being given. And when the testing end of things is being handled and manipulated and changed by certain powers that be in the instructional component is not necessarily aligning or matching all of those changes, that's where you get kind of the skew, right? Another thing that's not taken into account with regard to the assessment scores and how they're tied to accountability ratings for school performance, teacher performance, student performance, this doesn't account for the students who refuse to take the test. And I don't know how many people know about this, even in our field, but technically, up until this year, parents could refuse to have the test administered to their student without any sort of penalty. You just got to find something else for my kid to do that day. And then this year, they changed it to where parents can't refuse, but students can refuse. And I don't think that this, affects a large number of students, but depending on the size of a campus, if you have you know, even 10 kids that refuse to take the test, that's going to affect your data, right? That's going to affect the outcomes in the scoring. When we talk so heavily about testing and everything is driven to the test performance because that's tied to accountability, because that's tied to funding, and that's tied to sort of our PR as public schools, there's a lot of pressure that comes with that, where it almost starts to feel like I'm getting away from the quality of what I'm trying to do, or I see my colleagues getting away from the quality of what they're trying to do as educators to meet this standard, this expectation. And that actually takes away from the quality of the lessons that I'm developing and delivering in a classroom. And so that feels like an internal conflict on some level, right?
And
So.
the joy of teaching, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I taught 8th grade U.S. history for years and years, and that's a heavily tested subject. It's really the first time students encounter a history star test. So there's a lot of pressure when it comes to that one, and it got to the point on my campus where it really just felt like a factory education that I was serving up kids, that everything that I was doing revolved around preparing them for this one test that they see one time at the end of the year. And I got out of it. I teach elective classes now. I absolutely love them. I have complete freedom to do whatever I want with this, and it's creative, it's innovative, it's using critical thinking skills, and I'm so much happier as a teacher now that I have the burden of that star test off of my shoulders. And it means I make less money, or that I'm not going to be able to receive TIA money. But to me, it's worth it. And the other thing that I just want to mention real quickly is that, again, I taught US history for years. You could take that US history star test and score a master's on it without knowing anything about US history. And you could take that US history test and not pass and know a ton about US history. It's not, I found that to be very unindicative of what you actually know.
And you know who else is happy besides you as the lesson planner? Your kids. They are having a great time in your class. Their learning experience is enriched, and it's a much better than it would be, as you said, in a factory setting where we just are memorizing the facts that are on the test. So, kind of bringing it home for our listeners, if we can't even get the basic scoring mechanic correct, maybe we should steer away from this narrative that our schools are failing because of their poor scores. This is the idea of accountability, which is another buzzword in education right now, because this is a troubling fact when paired with the fact that these scores are the leading driver of these perceptions and these ratings that the schools get. In fact, in Texas, the scores of the standardized tests is the primary metric that we use to evaluate our schools. And from the parent's standpoint, is among one the first things that families look up. Hey, I'm going to be moving to this new city or this new district. Let's see how the schools are, right? Let's look at the schools, which is a driving perception of this idea of school choice, which Matthew talked about earlier in the episode. Ironically, though, as just a side note, these test scores do not apply to private schools, parochial schools, or certainly homeschools. So the metric is not even being applied necessarily the same across the board. So how do we know that those schools are better? But that's beside the point. Let's put aside the idea that standardized testing is the end all and be all of what makes a school good. It just isn't, frankly. Schools have so much to offer communities and families outside of how they do on these constantly changing tests. Your neighborhood public school is awesome, whether it got high scores or low scores. And I think that we should consider how public perceptions of these schools are so directly tied to this one metric that is A, not necessarily reliably scored, and B, as Matthew talked about, not necessarily predictive of long-term outcomes for students. So, Matthew and Natalie, in closing here, what is your take on this whole assessment and accountability debate? Not necessarily from the mindset of us educators, because you know how we feel, but kind of putting yourself in the shoes of parents and families and students who are listening to us, what does accountability really mean to you? And what should families be considering when they assess their neighborhood schools?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's complicated, and it's a hard one. I do believe that there has to be some clear metric of accountability related to academic performance. I do believe that there has to be some degree of testing to measure academic performance, and that schools should be accountable to that. That being said, you're absolutely right, Lance, that the STAR high stakes standardized testing is not the end all be all, nor should it be. I think that you have to look at a school holistically in terms of parents considering where to send their children. You know, I think it's a number of things. Electives offered, number of electives offered, special education support, tutoring options, after school programs, sports, the diversity of the school, the diversity of the staff, you know, teacher ratings could be a way to for parents to measure, determine where they want to send their student. It concerns with safety should be a determinant. So there are a number of things that you can take into consideration that should be clear and visible to parents when they're making those hard decisions.
I agree with all of that. I think that could be some valuable, I don't know, feedback in the spaces where they're still discussing this, maybe come next session. I haven't heard anything about a special session called, certainly not around this matter, so I don't anticipate that. But I could be wrong. I don't know. The idea that we are making a grade of accountability based strictly on test scoring as, like you were talking about, Lance, a fundamental deciding factor for families that are relocating or trying to establish themselves in a community. I think that if we're going to continue to publish that, we should publish the rest of it. We should also publish data and information on those special programs and supports that are offered. The role, like, what about like a community grade? What about the instructional prowess or growth of students and teachers, like where are the grades on that? Because I don't know about y'all, but at the beginning of every school year, at least in my district, our campus looks at and reviews data, not just on STAR performance, but also on student progress, passing, promoting, there, and a lot of times that data is skewed. My campus's testing data, we might do really well on a test, but when it comes to, promotion of students or passage of courses, that number could be lower. Other campuses see it vice versa. They're passing everything. They're doing great in the classroom, but they're not passing the test with the same rates of success. So there's so much, that one snapshot of data does not demonstrate. And even down to the student performance, if a student is not a good test taker, they may not do well on that test in that environment. I know a handful of students who consistently do not do well on tests, and yet they crush it on the instructional performance day to day in the classroom. So they are learning and they are growing, but the test isn't reflecting that for whatever reason. So, I just think that there's a lot to do to clean up that data. Data is always skewed to the person who is presenting it, right? And so I think that we need to have some more thorough and transparent and holistic, I like that word that y'all both use, holistic snapshots of what schools are actually accomplishing.
Well, I can't claim that was my word. I think, Matthew, you kind of hit that one out. So well done. Well said by both of you. So just kind of in closing with this 89th session in the rearview mirrors and lawmakers back home, I do hope that Texas families will skip past that headline of school testing failure that we talked about before and just kind of rethink what it means to hold a school accountable, as Matthew and Natalie were both just talking about. Even as we will lose some families to the allure of so-called school choice in the next couple of years, we should continue to support the millions of students who continue to come through our doors in the public education system. And at the very least, the weight of standardized testing should be dramatically reduced from the parents, from the families, and inside the minds of the kids themselves that are taking them when we evaluate and discuss our local schools. Otherwise, we will run the risk of crying foul that our schools are failing based on fundamentally erroneous or unimportant data, then leading to less funding, and then ultimately ushering in the exact failure that we are trying to prevent. So, in closing, think about public ed, think about accountability, and of course, most importantly, follow us on IG, Instagram for my older listeners, All Things Education Podcast is the handle there, and send us a voice note with your thoughts. We love to hear from you. Until next time, have a great summer, everybody.
Bye, y'all.
Adios.
Thank you for listening to All Things Education.
Be sure to leave us a review and share the show with everyone you know.
And if you liked what you heard, stay tuned for more compelling conversations with Natalie, Matthew, and Lance.
Until next time, Texas.